Iran describes as historic shame. The U.S. refusal to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and rejects an offer of informal talks over the accord. An alliance of U.K. aid agencies warned that the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and in South Sudan. Also in the headlines, protesters in the Armenian capital Yerevan storm a government building demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan amid a raging political crisis. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran denounces the new U.S. administration's refusal to return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
As long as the U.S. does not correct its wrong path, there will be no change in Iran's policies. For the last 2 months, President Biden's administration has not accepted to return to his JCPOA commitments, even verbally. This is a historic shame for President Biden. We are practically facing a different administration of what he had promised in his election campaign.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that President Joe Biden had a bad start regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He says that Iran has not seen any changes in the U.S. policies regarding the accord. Khatibzadeh noted that it is Washington that needs to initially act and lift the anti-Iran sanctions. He said that Iran will only return action for appropriate action. Khatibzadeh once again ruled out any informal meeting with the U.S. offered by the EU. He said that the EU should know that mutual respect and cooperation is the only way to resolve the issues. Commentator Brian Berletic says the U.S. and the EU try to force Tehran to pay the price for Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
The U.S. poses as a global leader, and it has obviously made a mistake, an error in judgment, and now it wants to force Iran to return to the negotiation table the U.S. itself walked away from conditionally, and I think the government in Iran is justified in being skeptical and reluctant. The EU's actions acknowledge that the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal was the wrong decision, that it was unjustified. They're telling a party of the deal that fulfilled its commitments that it needs to pay the price for the U.S. walking away from the deal. The EU should stand by its at face value commitment that the deal was violated by the U.S., not Iran, and they should continue forward with the deal.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors has held a meeting to discuss a quarterly report. The agency's Director General, Rafael Grossi, talked to reporters after the meeting about Iran's nuclear program. Our correspondent, Homolesky, joined us earlier with more details on the matter.
The press conference just finished just a minute or two ago, and in that press conference, as you say, Mr. Grossi was asked questions about the recent bilateral technical understanding that was reached between Iran and the agency, and he said again that this is basically a 90-day opportunity, giving time for political negotiations to come up with a solution to what he described as a very complex situation. Now, the Director General has confirmed time and again that because of this temporary agreement that he was able to reach with Iran, the agency does have the current verification and monitoring ability that is needed to confirm the types of activities that Iran is undertaking. But he said that he doesn't want the IAEA's work and inspections to be a bargaining chip at the negotiating table when it comes to the political talks. So what he was saying is that he hopes that all sides can continue with these discussions, but that he hopes that it will preserve the work of the agency. And I did ask him, well, if we assume that the JCPOA, for instance, does collapse and does not exist, where will that leave Iran and the agency? He did say, of course, that Iran, as an IAEA member state, as a signatory to the NPT, does have a comprehensive safeguards agreement with the agency that does give the agency some level of access to Iran. It will go back to that.
Iran's defense military has delivered dozens of overhauled aircrafts and engines to the Air Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iranian specialists prepared and overhauled all the equipment despite the ongoing sanctions that prevented Iran from acquiring needed parts. Saman Khajuri has more.
The Yuan's defense ministry has delivered 9 military and transportation planes, 10 choppers, and tens of engines repaired at Yuan Aviation Industries Organization to the Iranian Armed Forces. Iranian specialists have overhauled 9 jet fighters, including F-4, F-14, F-27, and Mirage types, as well as transportation types of planes, including C-130, 707, and 747. The types of the 10 overhauled helicopters range from 204 and 205 to 212 and 214, which have applications in combat and rescue operations. The engines overhauled include turbojet, turbofan, and turboshaft types.
The enemy was in vain efforts to defeat Iran through sanctions and restrictions on buying military equipment, but the country conquered the enemy by reliance on indigenous capability, building military equipment, and optimizing defense equipment. Iran's successful strategy has defeated the enemy's maximum pressure policy.
Iran has utilized capacities of domestic knowledge-based companies in overhauling and repairing the helicopters and planes.
The Air Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a dynamic, innovative, and self-sufficient sector, which is completely reliable for operational purposes. The delivery of several planes and helicopters to the force indicates the creativity of our experts with which we have optimized and upgraded our equipment. We will defend our country's borders under all conditions in the best way.
In recent years, Iran has made great strides in the defense sector and become self-sufficient in producing essential military hardware and defense systems. Iran has repeatedly made it clear that its military might is merely defensive and that it poses no threat to other countries.
Iran says at a time of sanctions, overhauling light, semi-heavy, and heavy military equipment is the most cost-effective and safest way to boost the country's defensive capabilities. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
An alliance of UK aid agencies have warned that the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening the humanitarian crisis in some fragile states, including Yemen. The warning was issued by the Disasters Emergency Committee, which is a group of 14 British charities that launch crisis appeals. In its report, the committee says parts of Yemen and South Sudan are already on the brink of famine. The report says the effects of the pandemic have crippled economies, making the world's poorest even poorer. Meanwhile, the United Nations has called for immediate funding to prevent large-scale famine in Yemen. While the UK aid agencies have appealed for support from richer donors, London says it is cutting some £4 billion from its own aid budget amid the coronavirus pandemic. Protesters in the Armenian capital Yerevan have stormed into a government building demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. This comes ahead of pro- and anti-government demonstrations that are expected later in the day. On Thursday, similar rival rallies were held in Yerevan. The protests follow remarks made by Pashinyan, who branded the army's call for his resignation as an attempted coup. The premier is criticized for his handling of last year's conflict with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The six-week conflict resulted in ethnic Armenians losing large parts of its territory. Pashinyan's critics see the loss as a national humiliation. The U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has met with Afghan leaders in a bid to revive a flagging peace process as violence soars in the war-weary country. Khalilzad met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and the chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, in Kabul. The U.S. envoy is also set to travel to Qatar, where he will meet with Taliban leaders. Khalilzad's mission comes as a Taliban militant group has called on the U.S. and its allies to withdraw from Afghanistan by May 1st. The Taliban made the call on the first anniversary of a peace accord sealed with the U.S. in Qatar. Under that agreement, Washington is to pull out all U.S.-led international forces in May.
On February 29, 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed a peace agreement in Doha, Qatar. Under the deal, which was officially titled the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, it was agreed by the U.S. to withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. Taliban also pledged to prevent Al-Qaeda from operating in areas under Taliban control and to hold talks with the Afghan government. The agreement came more than 19 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. It was after the September 11 attacks in 2001 when then-President George W. Bush ordered the invasion.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
American troops entered Afghanistan looking for Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, claiming the government of Afghanistan was sheltering him. They promised to drive out both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants. At first, just more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers were sent to Afghanistan. The numbers kept growing every year. While every U.S. government promised to end the war in Afghanistan, the flames of conflict became bigger.
This month, our combat mission in Afghanistan will be over. Our war in Afghanistan is coming to a responsible end.
I can tell you, after 19 years, we'd like to bring our young people back home.
The U.S. Central Command Combined Air Operations Center says the U.S. Air Force dropped a record number of 7,423 bombs on Afghanistan. More than 100,000 Afghans have been killed or wounded since 2009, when the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan began documenting casualties. After nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion has achieved very little. Violence still rages on in Afghanistan, with thousands of people getting killed each year. Washington did not manage to drive out the Taliban. Instead, the militant group now controls much of the country. 20 years of bloodshed amid what the U.S. government insisted to call nation building did not produce the political results Washington was after. That's why they stretched their hand to the Taliban for peace. American troops invaded Afghanistan to drive out the Taliban, but instead were forced to recognize them. The Doha peace agreement shows that America finally accepted the fact that Afghanistan's fate was never going to be determined by them. Afghans choose what's best for them without the help of foreigners.
Syrian air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles as the regime carries out another act of aggression against the Arab nation. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Syrian air defenses have responded to Israeli air raids over Damascus. According to Syrian military sources, the Israeli regime conducted several air raids targeting areas around the capital. The attacks were carried out from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. Syrian air defense units intercepted most of the rockets. The Tel Aviv regime regularly violates the Syrian airspace and conducts air raids on the Arab country. Now, let me ask a couple of our guests to join us with their comments on this subject. So we'll have Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign is joining us from Edinburgh, and also Mohammad Qasim, political commentator, joining us out of Beirut. Let's go to Edinburgh. Mick, in broad daylight, this is happening, and it's not the first time, as you know, that the Syrian airspace, the sovereign country's airspace, is being violated. Israel taking, it's just getting away with impunity.
Will be aware how Israel reserves to itself the right to overfly Syria, to overfly Lebanon, absolutely routinely. And of course it's a gross violation of sovereignty and of international law, but for Israel they insist on having this right against neighboring countries. I mean, this is part of what Brigadier General Kochavi, their chief of staff, spoke about at a recent seminar, the battle between the wars, it's known as in Israel. And essentially it means that Israel from time to time attacks its neighbors in very large, standard wars, set piece battles, or sometimes a country like Egypt will find itself fighting Israel to recover land. But in between these wars, Israel is committed to constant attacks on neighboring countries. And the idea is that Israel must maintain a military balance against any conceivable coalition of Arab and other Middle Eastern countries so that it can always win. But of course, Israel's a very tiny country. It's only 6 million Jews surrounded by a roughly larger number of Palestinians and hundreds of millions of other people in the Middle East who don't take kindly to the colonial project. So it necessitates regular violence. The attrition, I think the military term is, against military capabilities. Mm-hmm. Now, the Palestinians are resisting. The Lebanese resistance delivered a serious blow to Israeli notions of invulnerability in 2006. But the peace deals with Egypt to jointly besiege Gaza, with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, with the United Arab Emirates. They are giving a green light. They are saying to Israel, business as usual, bring your tourists to Abu Dhabi, and if you're bombing Syria at the same time, it's not a problem. So Israel does this, and I think it's important to realize it's not a policy so much as an imperative, given that their goal is ethnic cleansing and a colonial project. It could not really be otherwise unless the leopard changed its spots very profoundly and ceased to be an ethnic cleansing state.
Okay, let's now turn to Beirut. We also have a political commentator, Mohammed Qasem, there. Mohammed, you heard Mick Napier comment about this and why Israel is doing this. Let's have your assessment of the situation and the goal that the Tel Aviv regime is pursuing by conducting those air raids against Syria.
Well, it's not the first time that the Zionist state is making an aggression against Syria. And it seems that there is a kind of correlation between the U.S. policy and the Zionist state policy. The Israelis now are well organizing these attacks in order to break down the balance that is made by the coalition between the Syrians, the Lebanese, some Iraqis and Iranians to face the new aggression against our countries. And this is the sixth time that Israel attacks Syria. Well, that it comes together with what happened also in Iraq, when the Americans also bombed Bukamal and as a response to what happened to their base. The same as Israel now doing as a response to what happened to their ship in the Gulf of Oman. And the main idea of these aggressions is that to control the Syrian Iraqi borders from one side, the Syrian-Lebanese borders on the other side, the coalition between Syria, Lebanon, and Iran on the other side. What is the main objective of this aggression is that Israel is trying to prevent what is going on in Lebanon. One of the aims is to attack all the bases that are supporting Syria against its against the aggression against Islam.
Okay. Thank you very much for insight and contribution. We had Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh, and also we had Mohammed Qasem, political commentator from Beirut, with their comments.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been found guilty in a corruption and influence peddling case. The court sentenced Sarkozy to 3 years in prison, 2 years of which is a suspended jail term. The court decided that the former president is guilty of bribing a judge by offering him a senior position in Monaco. That was in exchange for confidential information about an inquiry into illegal payments to his presidential campaign in 2007. Sarkozy, who led France from 2007 to 2010, has denied any wrongdoing, calling the trial a witch hunt. He's the second former French president to be convicted of corruption after the late Jacques Chirac. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Donald Trump placed his perceived political interest over stopping a pandemic, says Mitchell Zimmerman, author, in an article published under the heading Trumpedemic. The coronavirus death toll reached 500,000 because Trump sabotaged the COVID response. Stay tuned for more. Economy devastated. 1 in 12 Americans sickened. Millions hospitalized. 500,000 dead. As we mourn 500,000 Americans who have died of COVID-19, we should remember that their deaths were not the inevitable results of a pandemic, not unavoidable acts of God. Most of the dead would likely be alive today. Most of the suffering America has endured could have been avoided but for Donald Trump. In Year of the Plague, Trump went from neglect and incompetence to sabotaging the national response, causing massive deaths. A cynical and self-absorbed man, Trump saw a lethal contagion only an opportunity for political gain. He calculated that his prospects for re-election would be advanced if he generated political warfare over the difficult steps public health authorities knew were needed. So he called coronavirus a hoax, mobilized his credulous base to go to war against public health officials, and systematically undermined efforts to confront the challenge. Trump understood coronavirus was no hoax. This is deadly stuff, he told journalist Bob Woodward in interviews early on. It's also more deadly than ever your extraneous flus. But Trump opposed actions disruptive of life as usual because he saw a rising stock market as key to re-election and feared that recognizing the crisis would spook the market. So he laid his political fortunes on opposing serious efforts to contain coronavirus and mobilized Republicans to resist precautions. Trump's assistants derailed efforts at outset to limit the exponential spread of the disease. Epidemiology researchers from Columbia University concluded in May 2020, if the country had begun locking down cities and limiting social contact on March 1st, 2 weeks earlier than most people started staying home, the vast majority of the nation's deaths, about 83%, would have been avoided. In a mere 2.5 weeks from March 18 to the beginning of April, identified COVID-19 cases would leap from 8,500 to 240,000 and deaths from 145 to over 7,000. Tragically, this was only the beginning. Once the disease had spread so widely, reining it in became exponentially more difficult. Slowing COVID-19's spread was hindered by long-standing weaknesses in U.S. healthcare system and U.S. threadbare social safety net. The one person own and operate the corporate media. They are doing everything they can to defend the status quo, squash dissent, and protect the wealthy and the powerful. The number of people without health insurance grew in Trump years, practically among people of color and vulnerable groups. And with no national requirements for sick leave, 7 in 10 of the lowest paid workers have no paid sick leave. Millions who contracted COVID-19 were reluctant to quarantine and slow to seek medical care they couldn't afford and risk their jobs. Trump's attacks on undocumented immigrants threatening their status if they use public services also made many reluctant to resort to medical resources specifically intended to safeguard health. a crowded housing where the less well-off resident with health impairing conditions such as pest, mold, chronic dampness, lead exposure, and inadequate heating exacerbated health risks. And people of color and the poor suffer disproportionately from asthma and other respiratory conditions that make them sitting ducks for COVID-19. All of these pre-existing social and health conditions have made tens of millions more vulnerable to coronavirus and accelerated its spread. Against this backdrop, Donald Trump turned to sabotage. He campaigned against social distancing, mask use, and closures. He convinced Republicans they were defending liberty when they behaved in a manner likely to spread infections, threatened public health officers, and defied public health requirements, inevitably thwarting the recommendations of by doctors, scientists, and public health leaders caused lives to be lost. No other country on earth has had as many coronavirus cases or deaths as the U.S. Combating a pandemic requires that the people of a country accept the need for sacrifice, that they act together, and that they have the support of their government to endure the death of loved ones, serious illness, loss of income, school closures, and limitations on contact with friends, family, and colleagues. It also requires government to recognize that the pandemic cannot be stopped unless the authorities address the reasons for vulnerability of those most afflicted. When instead a president mobilizes as many as a quarter or a third of the population to rebel against the discipline needed to contain the pandemic, it becomes nearly impossible to control the outbreak.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the region of South Asia, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We'll try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the coup d'etat in Myanmar and the whole story behind the decades-long internal conflict. Then we throw more light on the after-effects of this drastic change for the Burmese people, as well as the regional and global perspectives on the unfolding events.
Burmese are out on the streets protesting against a coup in which Myanmar's ruling party, led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, was deposed by the country's military. Daw Soo and President Win Myint, along with dozens of their ministers, their deputies, and members of the parliament, are being kept in confinement since many weeks, while the country is at the scene of almost everyday bloody clashes between the police and the people.
It was early in the morning of February 1st when Myanmar's military toppled the government, officially ending a short test run of democracy in the country. Should the day have unfolded as planned, the parliament was due to swear in the newly elected members, thereby enshrining the results of the November election. but the army took over the country to reinstall stratocracy, an amalgam of authoritarian ideas parading as majority-driven. Like all similar coup scenarios, the military cut all communication services, declared a state of emergency, and detained senior figures of the civilian government, most notably Daw Aung San Suu Kyi.
The military has played electoral politics, the game that they have lost. Every time they held elections and Aung San Suu Kyi and Popular National League for Democracy contested. Yet in the last 30 years, since 1990, the military held five elections, including one by-election in 2012. The first one, 1990, second one, 2015, which NLD did not participate, and then 2012, and then 2015, and 2020. Four out of five past elections in 30 years, Aung San Suu Kyi and her Popular National League for Democracy defeated the military-backed political proxies in the parliament in crushing or landslide wins. So therefore, the military as an institution did not want to play this game where they are beaten every single time they play against a Popular Democratic National League for Democracy.
The celebrity activist became the first elected head of state following about 20 years of opposition against the military junta, most of it in house arrest. She is the youngest daughter of Aung San, the father of modern-day Myanmar. He was the man who founded the new Burmese army. The dethroned ruling party was supposed to be Myanmar's comeback to the democratic world after over half a century beset with political instability, especially since 1948 when it declared independence from Britain.
About a decade ago, the country's military rulers felt they needed a more democratic look for better interaction with the international community. Emboldened by their sense of popularity among the Burmese, the military, or Tham Tharwa, decided to let Daw Su's political party have a chance in the election 5 years later. Her sweeping victory was promulgated as the country's democratic rebirth. But in reality, almost everything was still under the junta's control.
Via Myanmar's military apparatus had made sure that key areas of power remain under its well-established reach, but the coup has revealed that Aung San Suu Kyi's wild popularity was still frightening for them. The general election in November sounded more alarms for the top brass as the National League for Democracy, Suu Kyi's party, won in a landslide and secured 85% of the seats. The main opposition party was led by the military and only garnered about 7%. It seems that the army did not manage to come to grips with the reality of their humiliating blow and called the election fraudulent. Most observers report otherwise. Despite the loss, the military still had enormous executive power as well as many reserved seats on top of the veto power over the parliament's reforms, thanks to their tailor-made changes in the constitution over the years.
Before the coup gave General Min Aung Hlaing complete authority over the country, Suu Kyi was about to start her new term as the state councillor, a position specifically invented for her. With powers akin to those of a prime minister, it was created to circumvent a phrase that bars anyone who has family members with other citizenships from becoming president. Suu Kyi's now deceased husband was British and her two children are UK citizens. But her power was limited as the military drafted constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats for unelected military representatives, essentially preventing the NLD party from amending the constitution.
Myanmar's Tatmadaw had made sure that key areas of power remain under its well-established reach, but the coup has revealed that Aung San Suu Kyi's wild popularity was still frightening for them. Although the former arrangement of power was still a blend of civilian government along with a powerful military, this was the closest Myanmar had ever moved towards democracy. That window is closed now, but the people who experienced a touch of democracy during the last 5 years don't want the dark days back. The future is grim, and days are gloomy for the Burmese protesters, who are getting injured and even killed during the military crackdown of the ongoing protests almost on a daily basis. Undeterred by the police killings, protesters have promised unrelenting demonstrations until their demands are met. On the other hand, the new boss of the country has warned of severe consequences for those who defy the orders, but the international community has called on the military to relinquish power and curb the heavy-handed crackdown. But what else could you expect from your typical Dawa military man?
The members of the Security Council expressed deep concern at the declaration of a state of emergency imposed in Myanmar by the military on the 1st of February and the arbitrary detention of members of the government, including State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint and others. They called for the immediate release of all those detained.
The Security Council, with its five veto wielders, is never going to agree on anything that is, you know, significant and impactful to the lives of like billions of humans. And, you know, Security Council is for all intents and purposes in a perpetual coma because it's so torn by a conflicting geopolitical and economic interest among the top five world leaders or leading governments. And so I'm not surprised that Security Council failed once again to take any meaningful action. And secondly, I think this is also the body that failed to act in the face of a genocide. You know, genocide is international interstate treaty, and Myanmar is clearly found to be violating the terms of this treaty. And, the Security Council has a responsibility to act, and it failed to do so. And so I'm not surprised that the British table motion or statement did not garner enough support or consensus to, it isn't even a binding resolution or anything. It's just a statement, condemning the coup. And that with respect to India and Vietnam, well, Vietnam is also a dictatorial one-party state, operating under the banner of socialism or like a semi-communism. And the Vietnamese the military, Vietnamese telecom companies are in cahoots with the Burmese military and its telecom industry run by the Burmese military and the cronies. And so it's just a matter of birds of the same feather sticking together. India is just an interesting case because India has not been supportive of Burmese democratic movement for the last 25 years or so, despite its initial support for democratic movement in 1988. Indian military has also been courting the Burmese military to try to counter the Chinese influences. So therefore, India has consistently backed the Burmese military regime when it comes to people's democratic aspirations or struggle. Since the Obama administration, the Americans decided to bring the Burmese military from the cold because it did not want Burma to be too close to China. And so the U.S. accepted, deeply flawed, even anti-democratic process dressed up as Myanmar Spring.
Back in 2011, the Obama administration was so excited to welcome Myanmar's democratic maneuver that the U.S. administration moved fast to remove the sanctions the U.S. imposed on the country earlier and restored the U.S. ambassador there. Barack Obama even paid a visit to Dosu's house in Yangon, where she had spent many years of detention. Now, the State Department has expressed support for the protesters, but what does it mean for their bilateral relations? Any adversarial move by the Biden administration would potentially push Myanmar to Beijing's orbit, which has described the coup as a major cabinet reshuffle.
When Suu Kyi finally made some sort of arrangement with the military and took power, she did not seem to be the same activist she was known and won a Nobel Award for. She was the actual top decision maker on many fundamental areas, including economy, healthcare, and education. However, not only she failed to end the country's drawn-out civil wars or recast Myanmar as a multicultural society, but also she sided with the executioners and denied the facts about the systematic genocide of Rohingya people by the military. She even went to The Hague to defend the military, perhaps to stay in power.
Roughly about 500,000 or 600,000 Rohingyas, and there are about 100,000 are in IDP camps, where they have been kept, against their will for the last 8 years. No livelihood opportunities, no school, no proper schooling, let alone universities. And the 100,000 Rohingyas are languishing in these IDP camps, which German Foreign Office officials consider a concentration camp. Camps. And then, you've got another 400,000 plus that are scattered across the different parts of northern Rakhine, and they are in open prison camps from where they cannot leave. They can't move from one city to another. They cannot migrate, legally. And so I think their situation remains rather dire. And with the release of ex-genocidal nationalist Rakhines, a lot of Rohingyas fear that they may be scapegoated again for another round of violence.
Her newly recognized support for the military junta don't seem to be helping her now, but it may keep bothering her conscience, together with those of all members of the board that gave her the Nobel Prize. She may have started as the country's heroine of democracy, but this seems like one of those narratives whose protagonist passes the grey area and becomes a villain as soon as she or he gets to power.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
All right, now to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Nesan Lin, who's a coordinator at the Free Rohingya Coalition from Frankfurt. Mr. Lin, welcome to this show again. So what led to the military coup in Myanmar? Was it expected?
Yeah, we know that this will happen after the election because military-backed Proudhon Party lost in the election, and the ruling party have got the landslide victory. So it is very simple. The military chief, Mia Aung Lai, he has the personal ambition that he wants to become the president of the country, and he's going to retire in a few months. So he thought that his Proudhon Party will win in the election and he will become the president. But when his Proudhon Party lost in the election, he was just accusing there is irregularity in the voter list and there is the electoral fraud. Those all are the lame excuse. And finally, he said, they detained the Aung San Suu Kyi and the president and also the political activists and the parliament member and successfully coup the power. So it is not the first time in Myanmar. It is third time since 1962, only 5 years from between 1962 to 2021. Only 5 years the civilian government ruled the country, but the civilian government didn't have the full power, but military was military had the de facto power.
So Mr. Lin, what will happen to the popular protests in the country right now, and how are these protests different from the protests that we saw in the past?
I was a young boy during the 1988 uprising, but if I have to compare with this 88 uprising and the now 2021, so now they have the curfew. They cannot assemble, you know, more than, they cannot gather more than 5 people, but they are still on, they take to the street and protesting, you know, 10,000 of people, and maybe across the country, a few million people are every day, you know, they are marching to somewhere and protesting the this military. So I think, you know, even the curfew cannot stop these people. So they are organizing the protests. The protests are increasing day by day. And this is also not going the pressure because, you know, in the beginning, the military charged the Aung San Suu Kyi with the, you know, export-import law. Now they added the another, you know, the national disaster law. And, you know, the president also. So they are not going to release. They are arresting the people every day. So they are not going to release. So what they need is, what we need is a strong international pressure. Like, you know, the U.S. already imposed a sanction, but most of the people from Myanmar, they are asking the U.S. military intervention.
Mr. Lin, before moving ahead, let's just please take a look at how the global media has covered this issue, and then we can come back.
A big concern is whether there will be violence or a public backlash against the military. Anticipating the coup, Suu Kyi, in a prepared statement, called for non-violent opposition. But the country is like a tinderbox, and a small incident could lead to conflagration. As important, there's every possibility that ongoing conflicts against ethnic armed groups could escalate. The crackdown on any dissent will undoubtedly extend to border states that are dominated by ethnic minorities, raising the risk of intensified conflict. The UN Security Council, China, the European Union, and the United States, among others, have urged the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN regional grouping, to help mediate in the crisis. The Indonesian plan also calls for ASEAN to facilitate dialogue between the junta and protesters, according to two officials and a third source familiar with it. Indonesia is pushing Southeast Asian neighbors to agree on an action plan over Myanmar's coup that would keep the junta to its promise of holding elections with monitors to ensure they are fair and inclusive. The takeover, coming against the backdrop of a deepening U.S.-China rivalry, pits the foreign policy strategies of the two powers against each other, and it thrusts Myanmar on the front lines of an increasingly tense geopolitical competition for global leadership. The U.S. has framed its approach to Myanmar as a push for democracy and human rights. The focus of Beijing, which says it has a policy of non-interference in the domestic affairs of other countries, has largely been on economic and strategic interests. The differences were clear in the response by the two nations to the coup. While U.S. social networks have often been reluctant to pick sides in political disputes, Facebook is taking direct steps to stop distribution of the military's narrative in the country. The company is curbing the reach of its information team and spokesperson, Brigadier General Zormin Toon, adding this same action will be applied to any additional pages that the army controls that repeatedly violate our misinformation policies, it said in a statement.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Lin. So, Mr. Lin, what are the consequences that you foresee in terms of the condition of the Rohingya and this coup?
Rohingya, let me talk about the Rohingya inside the country. There are about the 600,000 Rohingya, about 140,000 are in the concentration camp since 2012, and the remaining are in the open air prison. So we are in the worst situation since 1992. We have no freedom of movement, very little access to the education, the healthcare, and all are, you know, the restricted. So they have, you know, already wiped off the majority of the people. Now they are taking shelter in Bangladesh. So what we are worried is, this May Online Merit 3 chief has said, you know, this is the Rohingya genocide is and finished business. So now he has the full power, and nobody can stop him. We are really worried for the people remaining inside the country. Maybe he can launch a violence against them and wipe up the remaining people from there. So at the same time, he said he will bring the refugee from, he used the term internally displaced, the people from the Bangladesh according to the agreement, bilateral agreement they had. So we are also really worried, you know, these people will be pushed back from Bangladesh, because Bangladesh is really happy with this, you know, the letter sent by the military regime to the Bangladesh government. So we are really worried, you know, these people will be repatriated without citizenship protection and ethnic rights and the right to return to the original villages.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Lin, for being with us on our show. Unfortunately, that marks the end of our question answer session. Many people have voiced their opinions on cyberspace and social media. Let's just take a quick look.
Matthew Tostevin tries to reflect the mass anti-coup demonstrations in Yangon, Myanmar. Karen Kin believes that while the people are empty-handed against the Juna and their weaponry, the power of people is more. Kenneth Roth refers to the deployment of an infantry division by the junta to defend the coup. He also mentions that according to the UN rapporteur, the division is responsible for the atrocities against the Rohingya. Although Muhammad Pakravon supports the movement against the junta, he criticizes the mainstream of the Democrats for being silent on the Rohingya issue, and he believes such a democracy won't last long and it's natural.
And that was our episode covering the coup d'etat in Myanmar and the whole story behind the decades-long internal conflict. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.